Search.
Session number 12907.
Rashford Real 6. Can you give me a general answer to a question about the specific officers who led you in your units in the battle for Northwest Europe and what you thought of the quality of the leadership and the kind of contrast with the class background they came from and so on?
Perhaps the 44th Royal Tank Regiment may be a bit different because I think the leadership was more than good, really, thinking about it. We had a very good commanding officer. I mentioned Jerry Hopkinson, who went on to become the Colonel Commandant and was a quite, although he was in his 40s then, he was physically extremely active. And he always led from the front. Our squadron leader, Major Cave, was again a man who led from the front and who later became quite a well-known industrialist, Sir Richard Cave. So we had a good commanding officer, a good squadron leader. The succession of troop leaders I had, I've mentioned one, Tony Gallagher, who was good in his demeanour and the way that he could speak to the men, and who was not an officer, shall we say, by birth, but was of that calibre. The second troop leader, Lieutenant Baker, had come up from the ranks and had got a commission and had come out from Dunkirk and was professional, and he also was not only of that calibre, but was one of us at the same time. And the two subsequent troop leaders, Lieutenant Turbutt and Lieutenant Ortino, I think were equally all right, insofar as the thing is that if you're in a tank and you're in the troop leader's tank and he is your crew commander, as well as you being your troop leader, your crew commander, and he sleeps with you, and he eats with you, and he's sitting there, then he does become one of you. And although you call him sir, then there's no other formality that you call him as an officer. And I think that overall we had good leaders, and they did not take unnecessary risks, but that they were always at the right spot, it seemed to me anyway. Well, it seemed to all of us that they were always a bit too pushy, you know. That they might have volunteered, we don't know, but we always felt that the 44th Royal Tank Regiment was being pushed in a bit more frequently than it should have been. But no, I think the leadership was all right. And I think looking back, that although the military discipline, the officer and the senior NCOs, we thought was overdoing it in periods of rest, where they insisted that we went back to basics of arms drill and foot marching, nevertheless, it kept the cohesion. And once you've got the cohesion amongst five people in the tank, then you get on extremely well together. So I would not say that we were lions led by donkeys, which has been applied to previous generation, as far as our unit was concerned. And also, we must recall that the 4th Armoured Brigade was led by Brigadier Carver, who subsequently became one of Britain's more thinking soldiers. So I would have no criticism against the British Army leadership as far as the Royal Tank Regiment is concerned.
But the more remote leadership, was there any sense of, in your unit, of people
It
saying,
was it.
it's all right for them, but we've got to try to do this?
No, we always felt that Montgomery, if he decided on a battle, that he would not place us at the disadvantage of unequal odds. We always felt that if, and this was a criticism against him, that he was a set piece general and that he plodded his way. But to us, it was very comforting to feel that if Monty was going to do something, then in all probability, we were going to come out all right at the end. It misfired at Arnhem. I don't think because of him, but because of the subsequent lack of reading the intelligence reports correctly. But it was generally felt that although Monty was a funny old stick and a bit square, at least he would not put his troops into impossible positions. So we felt that by the time the structural commander got out of the regiment and out of the brigade, it was in good hands after that. I mean, people like Left General Horrocks we'd heard of, but we didn't know them at all. I mean, just a name. Montgomery was more than a name because most people had seen him, actually. I'd seen him when he came down to the 58th Young Soldiers Training Battalion and fired us with enthusiasm with one of his little speeches. So, in general, I think that we thought that, well, if Montgomery is going to do something, then he'll do it as best he can, but he won't put us at a disadvantage, and that it should come out all right at the end.
What personal impression did Montgomery make when he visited you?
We must recall that it was a very, very, very cold January day. We had formed up on the square at Bovington at 8 o'clock in the morning, and we stood for 3 hours until he arrived, so that we were numb at the time. But he got up on the bonnet of his jeep, and within a matter of 10 minutes, we did really feel that, yes, once the second front came, that it would be the start of the end. His orders of the day rather gave us a chuckle, because his orders of the day were written in rather stilted language of, let's knock the enemy for six. But apart from that, we felt that he was going to at least give us the best chance of doing anything.
What were his personal peculiarities on seeing him?
He was a little stiff. He was unbending, not a great sense of humour, and somebody that you knew you couldn't really have a smoke and a drink with, because there wouldn't be any common ground.